Out among the olives, as I began to fit stones into place in the wall I was building, I thought, as if it were the first time, about what I wanted. All of my life, people had chosen for me. My father, or the king of Sunnis, his magus, or the king's other advisors. All my life they had made choices for me, and I had resented it. Now the choice was mine, and once it was made, I would have no right to blame anyone else for the consequences. Loss of that privilege to blame others unexpectedly stung.
Sophos, whatever you do, choose what'll make you happiest.
Unhappiest.
Wait, what?
I'm Noelle.
And I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Blythe.
That's right, our first post-pandemic guest. This is the Aetolian Archives, your Queen's Thief reread podcast to get you through the wait for Return of the Thief.
It's July 26th, 2020.
I opened my August calendar yesterday and saw the false previous Return of the Thief release date for the 25th. And for a second,
no!
I got so excited before remembering the date has been moved, and I just forgot to delete the calendar entry.
I genuinely, at this point, don't even know when it's coming out. Like, I know I pre-ordered it, but it could come out tomorrow, and I wouldn't know until they shipped me the book.
No, yeah, I've given up.
Still October 6th.
Okay, I think. Surprised.
Yeah, it'll just be a nice little surprise. I'll be like, oh, a package for me? A book? What is this? And then I'll open it, and then I'll run around screaming for like 20 minutes.
I didn't even know she was writing this one. It just came out of nowhere. This is a chapter where Sophos escapes slavery by passing a vibe check. Like, he gets up and he's like, I'm leaving, Octo. And Octo's like, sounds right.
Roll for persuasion. This does... I feel like this would be a really fun book to view in the context of, like, as if it was a D&D game.
We were thinking about that when we were reading The Thief. But then we sort of forgot about it.
I was actually thinking the other day, a D&D group that I'm in is exploring a temple right now, and it has a hidden room in the middle, and it was making me think about, like, D&D dungeon based off of the temple in The Thief.
Yeah, if this one were a D&D campaign, it would be a lot of charisma-based rolls.
Yeah, which Sophos does surprisingly well on.
So, a lot of emphasis is placed on choice in this chapter and the last chapter, how this is Sophos' pivotal moment where he has to choose if he wants to try to go back to that life. But what's interesting is, like, okay, sure, it was his choice, and he had that whole conversation with Moira last chapter about choice and what does he want, but it also comes down to Octo's choice, and Garone's maid has a choice here, too. So, like, if either of them hadn't been on board with helping him out, this might not have worked, which I had never considered on previous rereads. That never stood out to me, but Octo could have said no.
Yeah, it's not just on him. But also, they really make it seem like it is.
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of wondering, why do you think that is? And I mean, I guess there is a little bit about, like, you know, when he's thinking this over, he realizes, you know, I don't have permission to go swim because I am a slave, and Octo could have waved his hand and all the men would have jumped on me and I couldn't have gone. So, like, he is thinking about it, but I feel like it's kind of more of a background detail.
Yeah, I wonder if it's got something to do with, like, royalty and sort of the weight that the choices and decisions of royalty and rulers have. And then also kind of remembering that this is being told in hindsight to Helen, so I kind of lost my train of thought there, but something about how he could also be understating things or overstating things, and how he's also kind of looking back on it with the weight, I guess, of having been Sunnis for a lot longer, relatively.
Yeah. It's a weird example of the way that different people's choices are valued in different ways. We can see when we step back that Octo's decision and the maid's decision are just as important as the choices that Sophos is making, but it's Sophos's choices that are going to be remembered as historically significant. And, like, he understands that their choices are important enough that he includes them in this story. But I think even Sophos is biased in that way. Maybe this isn't right. But I feel like the series as a whole, like, moves further and further towards the perspectives and value of actually disenfranchised people as it goes along. Like, in the first book, Jen is pretending to be a poor person, but then actually, he was a noble all along.
Sounds like a lot of people at Hampshire College. Sorry.
Gotta take a minute to dig at the alma mater. I support it. But then we have Thick as Thieves, where it's actually about Kamet, who is actually a slave. And he's not like a prince who, through unfortunate circumstances, ended up a slave for a couple of months. He's been enslaved his entire life.
That's actually something that I hadn't really thought about, is sort of the parallel between Sophos and Kamet. I pronounce it Kamet, sorry.
A new chapter.
We're probably wrong every time.
I've actually was noticing when I was reading this that I have a serious problem of mentally pronouncing Edis as Edis every single time, even though I know that the characters would be saying Edis.
Wouldn't they be saying Edis?
Well,
wasn't that the old pronunciation?
Yeah,
Edis,
so
right?
Only the Edisseans would be saying Edis, like. And maybe people who are, like, friends with Edisseans, but, like, reading King of Atolia, I was, like, reading it as Atolians saying Edis, and I was like, wait, that's not right. None of these Atolians would be saying Edis.
Yeah, they're probably saying Edis, and Jen's eye is twitching every time.
Yeah.
Something else that interests me about this choice that Sophos makes is that, according to him, in this account of the story, he's not thinking about Helen right now.
Right. I'm sure.
The way he tells it is, I was just thinking about how I'm going to go and I'm going to be a failure and it's going to suck again, but I have to do it. And not like, if I had stayed, he would never have seen her again.
Oh.
Thanks, Noelle.
And like, he's framing that as the choice that would have made him happy to her.
Yeah. Which is weird.
To be fair, as we see, like, much later in the book, Sophos is not always very smart about Helen's feelings. He is, in fact, noticeably bad at thinking about Helen's feelings sometimes, even though they care about each other very much.
He's a bit obtuse.
Yeah. But yeah, that's true. He's literally talking to Helen, and he doesn't say anything about, like, oh, but of course, because I love you so much, I came back.
And, like, is that out of him still feeling at that point, like, he doesn't want to admit how important she is to him?
We get in, like, after, in the next, like, section or whatever, when it's revealed that he's talking to her, don't we get something like he, you know, he's still not sure at that point if she does want to marry him, and he feels like he's not really enough for her, so maybe when he's telling the story, he doesn't want to, like, presume that her feelings haven't changed. That's where I kind of see this coming from.
And maybe, because I think he becomes more willing to include the idea of her as a factor in his experience as this story goes on. And, like, is that a change in his comfort with doing that as he's composing this, which would have taken time during which he is with her?
Both in, like, fandom terms and in the books, Sophos and Helen's relationship gets overshadowed because Jen and Irene are so busy, like, being dramatic, throwing ink pots, dismembering each other, getting wounded, fainting, drawing guards into potential threesomes, you know, whatever.
They're definitely the intention seekers.
Yeah, and so then,
out of all the ships.
It's like, if Sophos and Helen are looking at that and being like, oh, I guess that's what it's like when kings and queens are in romantic relationships. Then of course Sophos and Helen are way more low-key about their relationship because they're like, in comparison to Jen and Irene, like, we're totally normal and we're not doing all of that. Is this really love? If we're not throwing ink pots at each other and having the guard? compulsory heterosexuality, but instead it's like
compulsory drama.
So, at the beginning of this chapter, we get more about this is when Sophos sees his father ride by, which is the catalyst for his whole choice, whatever. And he narrates, "I was a failure as a prince, a man, and a son, and I doubted very much that he would care that I was still alive."
Wow. So depressing, and it's not even true.
Yeah, you know, this opinion and Sophos's other opinions about, like, his father just hates him. He says later in this chapter he thinks he would be returning to being despised as useless and unwelcome even in my own home. It's at such odds with his father's behavior in the next chapter, so I just want to keep this in mind as we go forward.
Yeah. It's like, his dad's definitely not the ideal dad, but he does care about him, both for selfish and non-selfish reasons.
Yeah.
And Sophos isn't even considering the idea that his disappearance might have led his father to maybe reconsider some of his behavior. Before we talk about Barone, let's look at our bag of coins and go to the break. Oh, Barone. She's so sweet. She's very gullible. And the maid is just, I picture her standing behind her, like, with her arms crossed, like, here we go again.
Just, like, forbiddingly shaking her head.
But even though the maid knows that Sophos is full of shit, she still helps. Because she knows he's not totally full of shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, she can tell he's not asleep.
There's...
That's what she says.
Yeah, that's also a thing that comes up in this chapter. The fact that, like, Sophos has some intrinsic air of
kingliness
to him, nobility, which is such, like, a Greek ancient literature thing.
I don't know that I would call it kingliness and nobility, though. Like, I feel like it was just, like, Octo was just kind of saying, like, you've clearly never worked...
You have no sense, is how he puts it.
Yeah, how he would spend, like, half the morning looking at a grasshopper, whereas if he had been born a slave, he would not have been able to get away with that, so he would not be in that habit.
I think it's interesting how Octo ends that little paragraph with "you have no sense," because you think it's going to be like, I can just tell that you're too good for this life, but Octo is actually like...
You just kind of suck at your job. You can go.
They don't have to account for him to anyone because he was, like, not supposed to be there in the first place, too.
Yeah,
true.
Right.
Which I think
that.
Is probably, if he had been actually bought and had been supposed to be there, Octo might not have let that happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. Speculation, but...
Yeah. This might be jumping ahead a little bit, but the whole thing of, like... The circumstances worked out just right so that he wasn't as likely to be missed. Octo letting him go, the maid encouraging Barone to go along with the plan. This all feels a lot like someone's interfering in the fates of humankind again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We were wondering last episode, you know, how much of this is human behavior and how much of this is the gods. So I feel like this is definitely, like, a lot of things that could have gone very wrong went right.
Yeah, I feel like A Conspiracy of Kings, like, really relies on coincidences, even more so than, like, other books. Like, Barone just happens to be there, and he just happens to know that she's nice, and he just happens to see his dad on the road, and...
Right. Yeah.
And, like, I don't want to not give credit to the characters in the story for the decisions that they're making, but they certainly are set up to make the correct decisions, which brings us back to that Helen quote of the gods know me so well that they can predict my decisions. It's not that they make my decisions for me.
Yeah.
Which, I was just reading that, because like I said, I was rereading all the books before this, and that also, I feel like, I don't remember if you guys have said this or not, but that also really reminded me of Jen and how Jen is so good at knowing what people will do.
Yeah, ooh, it's very godlike of him.
Ooh.
And in this, wait, is it this chapter? Yo, it is this chapter. In this chapter, Sophos prays to the god Eugenides.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, does he? Where is it? I totally
missed
that.
Yeah, that when he's talking to Barone, he's praying to Eugenides that Barone will remember him, will not remember him as a prince, but just as a slave. And then he realizes she doesn't even remember him as a slave.
Yeah, I crack up whenever I read that. Oh, she said, you're that slave I bought. It's just so anticlimactic. She doesn't even remember him at all.
This whole human being whose life I interfered in.
Yeah.
But he prays to Eugenides, and like it feels like a continuation of the way that he's been thinking, what would my friend Eugenides do for the whole book?
Yeah. And he calls Eugenides the old god of deception.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like secretly this whole book series is just Jen going around converting all of his friends to worshipping Eugenides.
It's a locally grown artisanal cult.
That's just what we called my middle school.
Oh, another thing I wanted to bring up in this chapter is that Sophos gets that houseboy beaten and he does not think twice about it.
Yeah, that, and then I think it's like, it might have been in the next chapter or something, he does something that I was like, that's probably going to get that person killed. Dude.
Yeah. Even though, you know, he caused those consequences for the houseboy without thinking about it, his conscience hits him over the head with Barone, who is the person least likely to suffer from any of his actions. Yeah. But he narrates, I was returning a bitter payment for her kindnesses, even if they were stupid kindnesses. And the maid says, like, you will remember what you owe her. I mean, okay, I guess we learn from the end of the book, like, she gets, like, yelled at, but it.
I don't want to make disparaging assumptions about Sophos, but I feel like this is Sophos kind of returning to his quote-unquote rightful social position.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Might also be some sexism.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sophos, I love you, but this does feel gendered, TM.
He wants to be, like, chivalrous towards her.
Mm.
But it is also worth noting that even though he has a little twinge of conscience about Barone, he still goes forward with it, with both her and what he did with the houseboy, because he has a goal here.
Yeah, that was one thing that I was thinking about throughout reading this chapter, was even though Sophos thinks of himself as not being king-like, he's very king-like in this chapter. He's really good at, I can never remember the difference, he's really good at strategy or tactics or whichever one this is in this chapter and the next one. And he's always like, oh, I'm terrible at everything that involves being kingly, but he's like almost on gen level scheming here.
Building walls is honest, and being king is inherently dishonest, maybe?
There is that
Helen
story
is honest,
in,
sort
yeah,
of,
and I was gonna say, mostly. There's the moon guy. Moon guy and his buddy.
Moon guy and his buddy.
I just read King of Atolia and I've already forgotten their names.
I always forget Cleamon. About that story. What was it?
Cleamon and Gerosthenes, maybe.
Yes, I think that's right.
If that's how you say it.
Gerosthenes?
Also, another really convenient thing is at the very end of this chapter when the brother shows up and is basically like, hello, I am planning to kill your father. He's so excited to just like, wink, wink, I'm supposed to wear my knife to dinner. Like, Barone is gonna know what's going on. The only person who that communicates anything to is Sophos.
Maybe he just wants to look cool in front of his kid sister.
What is it? What constitutes a long knife? At what point does it become a sword? I might say the word dagger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I think of anything
sword,
with two sides.
Mm-hmm. I probably would have known at one point, but I have purged that information from my brain as useless.
If somebody attacks me in a dark alley, I'm not going to be like, wait, is that a dagger or is it a long knife?
Is it a dirk? Would you call it a short sword? Maybe, no, actually, I don't remember the word well enough to continue this joke. Never mind. I was going to try and name a really obscure type of knife, except I realized I don't know how to pronounce it.
Pronunciation strikes again.
Yeah.
It's our Achilles heel.
Don't you mean you're a sheel heel? Fun fact, Ender's Game ruined me for correctly pronouncing Achilles, because there's a character in it where his name is spelled Achilles, but it's pronounced Achille because he's French.
That's the worst.
Yeah.
I don't even want to know that. as a fun fact. It's an unfun fact.
Anything involving Orson Scott Card is an unfun fact.
Yes.
There is no wolf to eat you, Bunny. I don't think we had gotten to that.
What did she mean by that? I mean, well, obviously she meant, you know, if you stay here, nothing bad is going to happen to you.
Yeah, like, you are free to make the choice.
Irene does get referred to in another, like, two chapters as the wolf at Soonis's door.
Yeah.
And, like, in this dream of Moira that he has where she says there is no wolf to eat you, he sees her as appearing in the barracks. Which I think that's the first, all the other times he has dreamt that he visited her in her library. And this time it's, she's coming down to see him. And I don't know if there's a significance to that. It's on him now. It's in his life. Like, he can't go to that refuge anymore.
And isn't there something earlier about how, as he accepts his life as a slave more and more, he dreams about the library less and less?
Yeah. Which makes sense when you think that the dreams were to, like, prepare him for kingship. But as he made it look less and less likely by settling in there, they proceeded. That's chapter 7. Next time, Sophos temporarily becomes the main character in a spy movie.
Thank you to Madeline K, Emily M, and Michelle C for becoming supporters of the podcast. There is a link at the end of our episode description for that if you're interested. Send us your comments, questions, and thoughts. Chime in at atolianarchives.tumblr.com.
Be blessed in your endeavors. We need to be the thank you for listening. This has been an amateur embroidery production. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, anywhere podcasts are available.
Book nice.